So as I mentioned yesterday, continue on with some more readings from the great disciples of the Buddha with Sariputta and Moggallana. And we're now going to be, I'll be reading some passages regarding their passing away. We've talked about their journey to find the Buddha, their enlightenment, their teachings, their particular qualities, and now we're moving on to their final days. So pretty much everything today, except for the very last sutta, if we get to it, is from the great disciples of the Buddha. And this one starting on page 51. So there's a fair amount of readings regarding his decision where to pass away. He realized that his life force was starting to wane and that he wouldn't be long for the world, and recollected that the chief disciples of the Buddha pass away before a Buddha passes away. So he went to the Buddha and told him what was going on and basically asked permission to relinquish the will to live. And the Buddha gave him that permission. And then Sariputta decided, after some consideration, to go pass away at the home of his mother. For various reasons, he kind of foresaw that she has the that she had the ability possibly to gain entry into the stream. With some teaching, she had been staunchly resistant to his path and also the teachings of the Buddha. So up until this time, but he thought maybe he'd give it one last try. So he arrives at the city gate, finds his way to his mother's home, and accompanied by a relative of his, Uparaveta, who went to his grand aunt, the Sariputta's mother, and said, "Grand aunt, my uncle has come." "Where is he now?" she asked. "At the village gate." "Is he alone, or has someone else come with him?" "He has come with 500 bhikkhus." And when she asked him, "Why has he come?" he gave her the message the elder had entrusted to him. Then she thought, "Why does he ask me to provide lodgings for so many? After becoming a monk in his youth, does he want to be a layman again in his old age?" But she arranged the birth chamber for the elder and lodgings for the bhikkhus, had torches lit, and then sent for the elder. Sariputta, accompanied by the bhikkhus, then went up to the terrace of the house and entered his birth chamber. After sitting down, he asked the bhikkhus to go to their quarters. They had hardly left when a grave illness, dysentery, fell upon the elder, and he felt severe pains. When one pail was brought in, another was carried out. The Brahmin woman thought, "The news of my son is not good," and she stood leaning by the door of her own room. And then it happened, the texts tell us, that the four great divine kings asked themselves, "Where may he now be dwelling, the marshal of the Dhamma?" And they perceived that he was at Nalaka, in his birth chamber, lying on the bed of his final passing away. "Let us go for a last sight of him," they said. When they reached the birth chamber, they saluted the elder and remained standing. "Who are you?" asked the elder. "We are the great divine kings, venerable sir." "Why have you come?" "We want to attend on you during your illness." "Let it be," said Sariputta. "There is an attendant here. You may go." When they had left, there came in the same manner Sakka, the king of the Devas, and after him, Mahabrahma, and all of them the elder dismissed in the same way. The Brahmin woman, seeing the coming and going of those deities, asked herself, "Who could they have been who paid homage to my son and then left?" And she went to the door of the elder's room and asked the venerable Chunda, his attendant, for news about the elder's condition. Chunda conveyed the inquiry to the elder, telling him, "The great Upasaka has come." Sariputta asked her, "Why have you come at this unusual hour?" "To see you, dear," she replied. "Tell me, who were those who came first?" "The four great divine kings, Upasaka." "Are you then greater than they?" she asked. "They are like temple attendants," said the elder. "Ever since our master took rebirth, they have stood guard over him with swords in hand." "After they had left, who was it that then came, dear?" "It was Saka, the king of the Devas." "Are you then greater than the king of the Devas, dear?" He is like a novice who carries a bhikkhu's belongings," answered Sariputta. "When our master returned from the heaven of the 33, Saka took his bowl and robe and descended to earth together with him." "And when Saka had gone, who was that that came in after him, filling the room with his radiance?" "Upasaka, that was your own lord and master, Mahabrahma." "Then are you greater, my son, even than my lord Mahabrahma?" "Yes, Upasaka, on the day when our master was born, it is said that four Mahabrahmas received the great being in a golden net." Upon hearing this, the Brahmin woman thought, "If my son's power is such as this, what must be the majestic power of my son's master and lord?" And while she was thinking this, suddenly rapture and joy arose in her, suffusing her entire body. And then Sariputta gives her some Dhamma reflections, reflecting on the Buddha, his teacher. "When the Dhamma talk was given by her beloved son had come to an end, the Brahmin woman was firmly established in the fruit of stream entry." So he was successful. So moving on, few lines here just about his passing away, which was quite shortly after that, before dawn of the next day, I believe. The novice Chunda still being his attendant. And then the venerable Sariputta passed away through that very illness. Then the novice Chunda took the alms bowl and robes of the venerable Sariputta and went to Sawati, to Jetavana, Anandapindika's park. There he approached the venerable Ananda and, having saluted him, sat down at one side and said, "Venerable sir, the venerable Sariputta has passed away. These are his bowl and robes. On this matter, friend Chunda, we ought to see the Blessed One. Let us go, friend Chunda, and meet the Master. Having met him, we shall report this to the Blessed One." "Yes, venerable sir," said the novice Chunda. They went to see the Blessed One, and having arrived there and saluted the Master, they sat down at one side. Then the venerable Ananda addressed the Blessed One. "Lord, the novice Chunda has told me this. The venerable Sariputta has passed away. These are his bowl and robes. Then, Lord, my own body became weak as a creeper. Everything around became dim, and things were no longer clear to me when I heard about the final passing away of the venerable Sariputta." "How is this, Ananda? When Sariputta passed away, did he take from you your portion of virtue, or your portion of concentration, or your portion of wisdom, or your portion of deliverance, or your portion of the knowledge and vision of deliverance?" "Not so, Lord. When the venerable Sariputta passed away, he did not take my portion of virtue, of concentration, of wisdom, of deliverance, or of the knowledge and vision of deliverance. But, Lord, the venerable Sariputta has been to me a mentor, a teacher, an instructor, one who rouses, inspires, and gladdens, untiring in preaching the Dhamma, a helper of his fellow monks. And we remember how vitalizing, enjoyable, and helpful his Dhamma instruction was." Just a quick footnote, as most of you probably know, Ananda at that point in time had not attained arahantship. He was on the noble path, but hadn't completed his work. Have I not told you already, Ananda, that it is the nature of all things near and dear to us that we must suffer separation from them and be severed from them? Of that which is born, come into being, put together, and so is subject to dissolution, how should it be said that it should not depart? That, indeed, is not possible. It is, Ananda, as though from a mighty hardwood tree a large branch should break off. So has Sariputta now passed away from this great and sound community of bhikkhus. Indeed, Ananda, of that which is born, come into being, put together, and so is subject to dissolution, how should it be said that it should not depart? That, indeed, is not possible. Therefore, Ananda, be an island unto yourself, a refuge unto yourself, seeking no external refuge. With the Dhamma as your island, the Dhamma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge. The commentary takes up the narrative thus. The master stretched forth his hand, and taking the filter with the relics, he placed it on his palm and said to the monks, "These, O monks, are the shell-colored relics of the bhikkhu who, not long ago, asked for permission to attain final nibbana. He who fulfilled the 10 perfections for an incalculable period and 100,000 aeons, this was that Buddha. This was that bhikkhu. He who helped me in turning the wheel of the Dhamma that was first turned by me, this was that bhikkhu. He who obtained the seat next to me, this was that bhikkhu. He who, apart from me, had none equal to him in wisdom throughout the whole 10,000-fold universe, this was that bhikkhu. Of great wisdom was this bhikkhu, of broad wisdom, of bright wisdom, of quick wisdom, of penetrative wisdom was this bhikkhu. Few wants had this bhikkhu. He was contented, bent on seclusion, not fond of company, full of energy, an exhorter of his fellow monks, censuring what is evil. He went forth into homelessness, abandoning the great fortune obtained through his merits in 500 existences. This was that bhikkhu. He who, in my dispensation, was patient like the earth, this was that bhikkhu. Harmless like a bull whose horns have been cut, this was that bhikkhu. Of humble mind like an outcast boy, this was that bhikkhu. See here, O monks, the relics of him who was of great wisdom, of broad, bright, quick, keen, and penetrative wisdom, who had few wants and was contented, bent on seclusion, not fond of company, energetic. See here the relics of him who was an exhorter of his fellow monks, who censured evil. Then the Buddha spoke the following verses in praise of this great disciple. To him who in five times 100 lives went forth to homelessness, casting away pleasures the heart holds dear, from passion free, with faculties controlled. Now homage pay to Sariputta, who has passed away. To him who, strong in patience like the earth, over his own mind had absolute sway, who is compassionate, kind, serenely cool, and firm as the great earth, now homage pay to Sariputta, who has passed away. Who, like an outcast boy of humble mind, enters the town and slowly wends his way, from door to door with begging bowl in hand. Such was this Sariputta. Now homage pay to Sariputta, who has passed away. One who in town or jungle, hurting none, lived like a bull whose horns are cut away. Such was this Sariputta, who had won mastery of himself. Now homage pay to Sariputta, who has passed away. When the Blessed One had thus lauded the virtues of the Venerable Sariputta, he asked for a stupa to be built for the relics. After that, he indicated to the elder Ananda his wish to go to Rajagaha. Ananda informed the monks and the Blessed One, together with a large body of bhikkhus, journeyed to Rajagaha. At the time he arrived there, the Venerable Mahamoggallana had also passed away. The Blessed One took his relics likewise and had a stupa raised for them. Then he departed from Rajagaha, and going by stages towards the Ganges, he reached Ukkachala. There he went to the bank of the Ganges and seated with the following of monks. He preached the Ukkachala Sutta on the Parinibbana of Sariputta and Mahamoggallana. Okay, and we'll get to that sutta in just a minute, but before we do that, circle back a little bit and talk a bit about Mahamoggallana's passing. Moggallana passed away a fortnight after his friend Sariputta on the new moon day of the month Kattika, October-November, in the autumn. The great decease of the Buddha took place on the full moon night of the month Vesaka, May, half a year after the death of his two chief disciples. The Buddha was in his 80th year when he passed away, while both Sariputta and Mahamoggallana died at the age of 84. The circumstances of Moggallana's death are related in two sources, the Dhammapada commentary and the Jataka commentary. Although these two sources share a common core, they differ in details, which no doubt stems from its embellishments in the course of oral transmission. The account here will be based on the Dhammapada commentary. Because the Buddha was so skillful as a teacher, leading countless people to the gates of deliverance, the populace of Magadha, for the most part, had transferred its allegiance from the various rival ascetic orders to the Enlightened One and his Sangha. A group of naked ascetics, resentful over this loss of prestige, pinned the prime responsibility for their hard times on the Venerable Mahamoggallana. They believed that Moggallana had won over their own adherence to the Buddha's Dhamma with his reports of his celestial travels, in which he related how he had seen the virtuous devotees of the Buddha enjoying rebirth in heaven and the followers of other sects, lacking moral conduct, suffering in miserable subhuman states of existence. These ascetics were so enraged about the loss of their popularity that they wanted to eliminate Mahamoggallana. Without accepting responsibility for their own misfortune, they projected the blame externally and concentrated their envy and hate on the great disciple. While the ascetics were hesitant to kill Moggallana by their own hand, they had no scruples about employing others to carry out their nefarious deed. Having procured 1,000 gold coins from their followers, they approached a band of brigands and offered them the money in exchange for the great disciple's life. At that time, Moggallana was living alone in a forest hut at the Black Rock on the slope of Mount Isigili outside Rajagaha. After his encounter with Mara, which we talked about yesterday, he knew that the end of his days were near. Having enjoyed the bliss of liberation, he now felt the body to be an obstruction and a burden, and had no desire to use his psychic faculties to keep it alive for the rest of the aeon. Yet, when he saw the brigands approach, he knew they were coming to kill him, and he used his supernormal powers to slip through the keyhole. The gangsters arrived in an empty hut, and although they searched everywhere, they could not find him. They returned the following day too, but this time the elder soared up into the air and escaped through the roof. The next month too, the bandits came, but again they could not catch the elder. Moggallana's motivation in escaping was not fear of death. The reason he used his psychic powers to elude the gangsters was not to protect his body, but to spare the would-be assassins the frightful comic consequences of such a murderous deed, necessarily leading to rebirth in the hells. He wanted to spare them such a fate by giving them time to reconsider and abstain from their crime. But their greed for the promised money was so great that they persisted and returned again the following month. This time their persistence was, quote-unquote, rewarded, for at that moment, Moggallana suddenly lost his psychic mastery over the body. The reason for this sudden change in fate lay in a terrible deed he had committed in the distant past. Many eons ago, in a previous birth, Moggallana had brought about the death of his parents. That heinous karma had brought him to a rebirth in hell for countless years, but it had not yet fully matured. A residue remained, and now, when he was in mortal danger, that residue suddenly ripened and confronted him with its fruit. Moggallana realized that he had no choice but to submit to destiny. The brigands entered, knocked him down, and pounded his bones until they were small as grains of rice. Then, thinking that he was dead, they threw his body behind a clump of bushes and fled, keen on collecting their reward. But Moggallana's physical and mental strength was formidable, and he had not yet capitulated to death. He regained consciousness, and by the power of meditation, he soared through the air and came into the presence of the Master. There, he announced that he would attain final Nibbana. The Buddha asked him to give a final sermon to the community of monks, which he did, with an additional display of wonders and marvels. Then he paid homage to the Blessed One, returned to the black rock, and passed into the Nibbana element without residue. And now, the last segment, the final word on Sariputta's and Moggallana's death is the Buddha's very well-known eulogy from the Ukacela Sutta. Once the Blessed One was dwelling in the Vajji country at Ukacela on the bank of the river Ganges, not long after Sariputta and Moggallana had passed away. And at that time, the Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by the company of bhikkhus. The Blessed One surveyed the silent gathering of bhikkhus and then spoke to them, saying, "This assembly, O bhikkhus, appears indeed empty to me now that Sariputta and Moggallana have passed away. Not empty for me is an assembly, nor need I have concern for a place where Sariputta and Moggallana dwell. Those who in the past have been holy ones, fully enlightened ones, those blessed ones too, had such excellent pair of disciples as I had in Sariputta and Moggallana. Those who in the future will be holy ones, fully enlightened ones, those blessed ones too will have such excellent pairs of disciples as I had in Sariputta and Moggallana. Marvelous it is, most wonderful it is, bhikkhus, concerning those disciples, that they will act in accordance with the Master's teaching, will act in accordance with his advice, that they will be dear to the four assemblies, will be loved, respected, and honored by them. Marvelous it is, most wonderful it is, bhikkhus, concerning the Perfect One, that when such a pair of disciples has passed away, there is no grief, no lamentation on the part of the Perfect One. For of that which is born, come into being, put together, and so is subject to dissolution, how should it be said that it should not depart? That indeed is not possible. Therefore, bhikkhus, be an island unto yourselves, a refuge unto yourselves, seeking no external refuge, with the Dhamma as your island, the Dhamma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge." Okay, the famous words of eulogy from the Buddha, expressing his feeling of the emptiness, essentially, of the assembly, but that how could it be otherwise, and reiterating the instructions to be an island unto yourselves, which he does several times in the last year of his life as well. I found that, just as rereading that and his comments to Ananda, just very moving and very instructive in a sense, you know, that, you know, as much as we all should take refuge in the Sangha as one of the triple refuge, that taking refuge in individuals even if they're great teachers of ours, taking refuge in them as individuals is not what the Buddha would probably instruct us to do. He would say, take what they've offered, use it, apply it inwards, and don't take individuals as a personality as your point of refuge. Take your own understanding, your own wisdom, bring it in, and let that be your refuge. So I thought I'd just read one last sutta of Sariputta, just to end with a sutta. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, the Khanda Samyutta. And it's Khanda Samyutta is chapter 22, and this is Sutta 122. On one occasion, the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahakotita were dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Then in the evening, the Venerable Mahakotita emerged from seclusion, approached the Venerable Sariputta, exchanged greetings, and said to him, "Friend Sariputta, what are the things that a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to?" "Friend Kotita, a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to the five aggregates subject to clinging, as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a dart, as misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as not self." "What five?" "The form aggregate subject to clinging, the feeling aggregate subject to clinging, the perception aggregate subject to clinging, the volitional formations aggregate subject to clinging, the consciousness aggregate subject to clinging." "A virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent, etc., as not self." "When, friend, a virtuous bhikkhu carefully attends to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of stream entry." "But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is a stream enterer should carefully attend to?" "Friend Kotita, a bhikkhu who is a stream enterer should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent, etc., as not self." "When, friend, a bhikkhu who is a stream enterer carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of once returning." "But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is a once returner should carefully attend to?" "Friend Kotita, a bhikkhu who is a once returner should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent, as not self." "When, friend, a bhikkhu who is a once returner carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of non-returning." "But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is a non-returner should carefully attend to?" "Friend Kotita, a bhikkhu who is a non-returner should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent, as not self." "When, friend, a bhikkhu who is a non-returner carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of arahantship." "But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is an arahant should carefully attend to?" "Friend Kotita, a bhikkhu who is an arahant should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging, as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a dart, a misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as not self." "For the arahant, friend, there is nothing further that has to be done and no repetition of what he has already done. However, when these things are developed and cultivated, they lead to a pleasant dwelling in this very life, and to mindfulness and clear comprehension." Okay, so should be clear now what you need to be contemplating all the way up and through and past arahantship. So I'll leave it there for tonight's readings. and wonder if there's any questions or comments. Got a microphone for Anthony.
Ajahn, I think, I was listening to the Samaditi Sutta, mm-hmm. and it goes through, I think, dependent origination all the way down, I think. And at some point it says that with the arising of the taints, there is the arising of ignorance. But right before that, I think it says, with the arising of ignorance, there is the arising of the taints. Kind of like it goes in circles. And I forgot what the taints are. I mean, of course, I could listen to it again, but yeah. It would be good to, if you can talk about that.
As a precursor to avijja, the arising of ignorance, because I may be remembering it wrong, but I thought it was the five hindrances that were the proximate cause for the arising of the...
It's a different sutta.
Oh, okay. The Samaditi Sutta talks about the...
Samaditi Sutta, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like those, similarly, that image that, actually, Sariputta gives of the two sheaves of rice stacked together. They depend on each other, and it's the same as Namarupa and Vijnana, and they're all one of them. Only one of them can be taken away, and the whole thing falls down. And similarly, it's sort of the taints and ignorance it's another way of looking at it, they're not. And it's kind of similar. They are conjoined. They are not disjoined. It's another lens to be reflected on or investigated.
So, were you asking also what are the taints? Or
yeah.
The asava is the Pali word.
Right. Yeah. One is ignorance and
kam asava, bhava asava, avijja asava. So the sensuality, the the taint of sensuality, the taint of becoming, the taint of ignorance. So that ignorance and the taints are kind of there's an interplay there.
Yeah, that's the Buddha refers to that on the night of his awakening as the final watch of the night, when he realizes the extinguishment or the ending of the taints, sometimes, the asava, sometimes translated also as the outflows. You see different translations. That's what realized, that's what he realized was the ending of the asava, which dispelled ignorance.
Yeah. Ajahn, from the reading, I believe I heard you say something about that you were reading an account from the commentary of the Dhammapada?
Yes, yes.
And I was just curious what
yes.
what verse and chapter he was commenting on.
Gosh, let's see. Verse and chapter. I'm going to probably have to get back to you on that just because it's in here on one of many pages that I flip back and forth, and I may not be able to find it very quickly.
Okay.
But I will let you know.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Yeah.
Longpur, the other day you mentioned the book Buddha Dhamma.
Yes.
And I was like looking at it a little bit, and it mentions dukkha, and in the dukkha section, you could say, it mentions dukkha as being pressure and resistance,
mm-hmm.
something like that. Do you mind talking a little bit about that?
Maybe. It's been a while since I mean, dukkha, as a as a term, as a Buddhist term, it has a very broad meaning and application. So it's all that is complicated, difficult, imperfect. Suffering in some way, shape, or form, small or little, or unsatisfying. That's the nature of dukkha, as a phrase or as a term the Buddha uses it. It has a very broad broad meaning. I have a comment just on the
yes, please.
Couple things came up in my mind when you're reading Moggallana's the account of Mahamoggallana and him trying to avoid the brigands killing him out of compassion.
Su Yun
is the obvious sort of one
of
the where he was beaten savagely twice by the kind of the Red Guards, the military.
Su Yun was Master Hua's teacher.
He lived to be 120, and he was badly beaten, and left for assumed to be dead by his disciples, and then he was just so badly beaten. They kind of nursed him, and he was really in and out, and that his disciples gathered around and sort of paid respect. You don't have to. Feel free to relinquish this body. I think he was about 112 then or something.
Yeah.
And, that you don't feel free to relinquish this life if you like. We're, as disciples, we can look after yourself. And he was sort of really sort of weakly, sort of, it's not because of you, it's because of them. And he didn't want the people who beat him to drop into hell for killing an arhat. So it's almost a modern time. That was in the 1950s. So within recent time, great beings. And then the other is like with Moggallana. Taking his kind of broken body and paying final respects to the Buddha, thought of Lumpu Sao, because Lumpu Sao was into his 80s, and he was quite sick, and he was on his last kind of his last tudong sort of and doing. With a bunch of disciples, and he said he wanted to go to Champasak, which is in Laos, and it's a pilgrimage site in Laos, Everybody was afraid, and they put him in a boat and were taking him down the Mekong, to Mekong River. It's along the banks of the Mekong River, and got him in this boat, and everybody was, is he going to die? He was in such bad shape, he was really sick. And then they let him know, they got stopped at the base of the where the monastery is on the banks of the river, and they said, we're here, and he kind of woke up and said, okay, help me up, and then they helped him up the banks up to the monastery and helped him get his robes on and helped him into the Uposatha hall where this very revered Buddha image was, and he bowed three times, and the third time seemed to be down for quite a long time. and the disciples came, and anyway, he passed away on his last bow.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Way to go. It's the way to go.
It's a good way to end.